and welcome to another episode of IAF Continued Conversations. My name is Bettina Solinger, and I'm the head of the International Academy for Leadership. And once again, I'm joined by Sven Gerst for this conversation. And today we will be diving into the topic of populism. And Sven, you might want to introduce our guest to our audience.
Yeah, well, as all of you know, I rather don't like introducing people because I always feel that's kind of weird. And I think Steve is already accustomed to that to a certain degree. But I want to give a little disclaimer before for our listeners and for many of those who have experienced Steve live in Gummersbach. He is one of our most beloved guests. And ever since I started inviting him to my seminars, we kind of gradually expanded his presence. So the last time he was even there for 2 or 3 days, taking on multiple sessions. And when Bettina was talking about the most interesting conversations, that's exactly what you will get with Steve, because these conversations are not limited only to the seminar room, but also to the dinner conversations, to the bar conversations. So the real Gummersbach feeling. But now, enough of my yapping. Steve, maybe you say a couple of words about yourself before I get away.
Well, thanks very much, Sven. Hard to follow a kind of intro like that. My name is Steve Davies. I'm a historian by training, although my work and writings venture over into other disciplines, notably economics, but also sociology, political theory, philosophy. I taught for 30 years at the Department of History and Economic History at Manchester Metropolitan University in Manchester in the UK, where I lived for over 40 years until very, very recently. I regard myself as a Mancunian, basically. Currently, I'm self-employed and I do work for various organizations and think tanks, as well as writing on my own behalf. I'm affiliated with and associated with the Institute of Economic Affairs in London, and also with the John Locke Institute and with the Institute of Humane Studies in the United States. And I've written a number of books on various topics, the most recent one being one about the subject of global catastrophic risk.
Well, speaking of global catastrophic risks, we are talking about populism today. And populism is, I think, one topic that doesn't need necessarily introduction to our listeners, because many of them unfortunately encounter the manifestations of the so-called populist wave in their own political realities. So when we talk about populism, when I started to investigate the topic, many articles came out, especially in journalism, that said, oh, well, it's just a new political tactic. It's about the rhetoric of very gifted, charismatic politicians. And in political theory, to a certain degree, there was also not one consensus. There are people like Jan-Werner Müller, who then gave it more flesh to the bone and like said it's a set of values. On the other side, you have people like Kas Mude, who would say, well, it's just a thin ideology that can be docked onto other ideologies. But, well, This was a discussion in political theory to a certain degree that I could not necessarily conceptualize when it comes to the political realities. How does populism play out? And so I came across your article that you wrote in 2017 or 2018, Steve, and it's called The Great Realignment in Politics. And that very much helped me to understand what is going on and why is populism such a prevalent phenomenon globally, right? Because everybody talks about populism. So before we dive into the theory, I want to ask you, what made you write this article at that time?
Okay. Well, actually, that article, I was asked to write that article by Jason Kuznicki at Cato Unbound at the Cato Institute, after I had already put forward the arguments that it contains in a number of online videos, talks to various audiences in various parts of the world. And Jason had heard me give one of these talks, and that's why he asked me to write it up in the essay for Cato that you just mentioned. Now, I first actually put forward this model or this thesis all the way back in 2007 at the Cato Institute, in fact, where I was talking to their interns at the time. And when I did that, it was in the nature of a prophecy, essentially. I was saying that I thought that this was what was going to happen, this process of political realignment, the emergence of what is commonly called populism, but which I prefer to call, for reasons that will probably become clear in our conversation, national collectivism. And so I then sort of developed the idea over the years since 2007, and then I've written it up. And I'm currently actually writing a full-length book setting out the thesis and model and explaining what's going on in contemporary politics or Polity Press, which should be coming out in the spring of next year. So it's a process that goes back a very long way. And what originally actually motivated me to start thinking about this was two things. One was a book, which I first read all the way back in 1999 by a friend of mine called Virginia Postrel, called The Future and Its Enemies. And Ginny argued that what was going on in the post-Cold War era, the era of early globalization with the Seattle summits and the riots that associated it, was a strange kind of alliance appearing between the protectionist right, people like Pat Buchanan, and the anti-globalist left. And that started me thinking about the kind of political changes that I could see happening in the circles I moved in, and in particular, the gradual breakdown of the fusionist alliance between conservatives and libertarians, which had dominated American and British politics under Reagan and Thatcher. And it became pretty clear to me that this was one of those unhappy marriages that was very rapidly heading for a spectacular and acrimonious divorce, which is what exactly I think has come to pass. And that was what in turn led me to start thinking about this phenomenon of realignment and to identify it as a historical process that has happened repeatedly and which is now working itself out today.
Well, I thought initially it must be due to something like Brexit too, because the populist wave, I mean, was lingering there somewhere, but it became to it came to global audience or global attention through the rise of Donald Trump and Brexit. I think these are the two markers where it became really mainstream political discourse around the topic of populism. But it seems that you have looked at it from a more analytical perspective even before. But Brexit did not inform any of those. But, I mean, you are somebody who has been very vocal on those issues, right?
Yeah, I was not surprised by Brexit in a way. I actually thought that the vote in the referendum was going to be a very small majority for staying in. So I was a bit surprised by the fact that Leave actually won. But I was not surprised that there was a referendum or that it was as close as it was, because I already had developed my analysis of realignment. And so what I then did in the aftermath of the referendum was to write a book called The Economics and Politics of Brexit, which explained that Brexit was not the cause of a realignment. It was rather the product of a realignment, a shift in the nature of the underlying preferences and priorities of the British voters, which is what had produced initially an upsurge in support for UKIP, a populist national right party, and then following on from that, as a result of David Cameron's attempts to deal with that phenomenon, the actual Brexit referendum. So Brexit was not a surprise for me. In a way, it fitted into and confirmed the model I had already developed.
Okay, and I think that's a good heuristic to look at different emergences of populism generally and globally, even in Germany. So let's dive into the Great Realignment. What is the Great Realignment? If you had to explain it in a nutshell, what is this new underlying shift that we see in politics?
The essential argument is that in theory, you could live in a world in which each person has their unique combination of positions on the 40 or 50 issues that any society will politically disagree about, which covers everything from, say, should you have the death penalty or not? What kind of foreign policy should you have? Should you have a Green New Deal or not? Should taxes be high or low? You know, you can all draw up a list of issues like that. And in theory, there are more ways of combining positions on those various issues than there are atoms in the universe. So it'd be very easy for each individual person in the country, even as large as, say, Germany or the UK or the US, to have their own unique position. But when you do the sociology of politics, you find out that that's not what happens. You find out that there are actually distinct opinion clusters. You find that people who take one view on one issue are disproportionately likely to also take a particular view on some of the other issues. So you end up with, like, typically 8 or 9 large clumps or clusters of voters within an electorate. Now, what you then find is that in terms of actual practical politics, these clumps of voters tend to always align into two broad camps. And this is because out of all the issues that there are in a political community to disagree about, there is typically just one or two that really, really matter to a lot of people. They are the aligning issues. They're the issues that typically reflect or grow out of very profound or structural divisions of interest or belief in society. They reflect either economic and class divisions, ethnic divisions, maybe fundamental questions of national identity or fundamental questions of ideology or belief, like religion, for example. And so because they matter, people tend to decide which side of the political division they're on by their view on that one aligning issue. And that means that they accept everybody else who shares their view on that aligning issue as being on their side, even if they disagree about lots of other things. Conversely, somebody who disagrees with you on that aligning issue is your opponent, regardless of whether or not you agree with them about lots of other things. Now, since really the 1920s, the dominant aligning issue in most Western democracies has been what you might call capitalism versus socialism. It's been about economics. It's been about whether or not you favor a broadly free market economy with private ownership of the means of production or a more state-controlled and directed economy. Ultimately, maybe a completely socialist economy like the Soviet Union or the other communist states of Eastern Europe. And that was the dominant issue in politics right through to the 1990s. Now, there were secondary issues as well. Particularly, there was a division over social liberalism versus social conservatism. And that meant that the two dominant poles of politics in Germany, the UK, France, America, wherever you care to look, was between one group of voters who were pro-market but socially conservative, which is like the classical CDU, for example, and another group of voters who were left of centre on economics but also socially liberal, which was the position of the SPD. After certainly Bart Godesberg, and certainly after the early 1960s when Willy Brandt was the leader and subsequently. And so that was the broad division, and that left two groups of voters who were up for grabs, if you will. The consistent libertarians, who were socially liberal and economically liberal, and the consistent authoritarians, who were both pro-government intervention in the economy, but also socially conservative. And this described a significant number of working-class voters in most Western democracies. Now, the point is that these alignments do not last forever. Eventually, after about 30 or 40 years, the old aligning issue breaks down. It stops being the dominant aligning issue. And a new aligning issue takes its place. And my argument essentially is that in the last 20 years, what we've seen in one country after another is the decline of economics as the dominant aligning issue, mainly because of the collapse of communism. The choice is no longer an existential choice between not just two kinds of economic policy, but two totally different kinds of society. It's now really just a technocratic choice between one kind of a policy that leans more towards markets or a policy that leans slightly more towards redistribution and government intervention. But it's no longer an existential choice. And now the issue that people do increasingly see as existential, which has now become the aligning issue, the issue that divides people into two camps, is the question of national identity. The question of whether or not you support the nation and a very traditional idea of national identity, or alternatively, you are relaxed about and support cosmopolitanism, globalism. This manifests itself most sharply in the question of your attitude towards migration, where on the one hand, you have people who follow the kind of Renaud Camus argument about great replacement and stuff like that, the argument that somehow there's an existential threat to the existence of European nations from large-scale migration from other parts of the world, and on the other hand, people who are much more relaxed about that and who actually welcome the kind of cosmopolitanism that you find in major cities these days. So my argument is that we've moved away from a politics in which the dividing line, the aligning issue, is ultimately economics, to one in which it's more about identity and above all about the issue between nationalism and cosmopolitan globalism. And in that context, the economic issue, though, is still there. And so what we're seeing in country after country is the appearance of parties that what I call national collectivists. These are the parties that are typically defined as populist or described as populist. They combine hostility to things like free trade, finance, a very open market economy, an open labour market. So they're actually left on economics in many ways. And they combine that with strong nationalism, anti-globalism, and strong hostility to things like immigration on a large scale.
So let's see whether I got that right. So in essence, you would be saying that, well, the nature of politics is bipolar to a certain degree, or at least, yeah, bipolar. And there's one issue that is of utmost salience, as we would call it maybe in political theory. There's a salient issue that would now be, for example, in pragmatic politics, something like migration. Like you framed it as national identity. And I mean, it's unsurprising that identity plays such a big role. We see Francis Fukuyama publishing on identity. We saw now Joshua Monk talking about identity. So identity plays maybe the salient issue that in the past, maybe to put it a little bit more playfully, like in boomer politics, it was like socialism versus capitalism, kind of like the Cold War kind of paradigm to a certain degree, the rivalry of economic systems. And now we see that this salient issue has moved away from economics to the topic of identity and migration. And the second kind of alignment process is still with economics. It was on social progressive issues in the past. And now it is mainly identity and economics that are the main salient issues that are kind of lumped together. What role does social progressivism in all of this play? I mean, to a certain degree, the globalists, as you would call them, they are also very progressive. They are, to a certain degree, even woke, some of the most radical versions of it.
Some of them are. On the side that is cosmopolitan, I would say there is a kind of division between what I would call liberal cosmopolitans and radical cosmopolitans. And it has to do with the question of wokeness, as you call it, the degree to which people assert or emphasize a vision of personal identity which makes personal identities radically subjective and chosen. And so you have some people, mainly found in the Green parties in many parts of Europe, but also elsewhere, who combine quite radical globalism with also a left of centre view on the economy very often, but particularly radical individualistic ideas of personal identity. And then there are, on the other hand, there are liberal cosmopolitans who are more moderate on those issues. They're not prepared to go down the full route of saying that, you know, whatever you are is purely a matter of what you feel you are. They're not prepared to go fully down that road. But they're basically on the same side of the issue about, say, cosmopolitanism versus nationalism, but they are divided because there's a spectrum of views, if you will, about identity, ranging from very moderate and conservative liberals, if you like, at one end, to very radical, sort of green cosmopolitan radicals at the other end. So, yes, there is a secondary division about that.
Yeah, I mean, to a certain degree, that's rather unpalatable for many liberals, right? That they would conceive themselves as cosmopolitans because liberalism is a universal concept, right? The idea of, for example, universal human rights, the concept of the open society is very much a globalist. Or a globalist has always this bad connotation. It always refers to something like the World Economic Forum or something. So they kind of hijack, to a certain degree, that vocabulary. But liberals would be clearly in the camp of a globalist or cosmopolitan spectrum. But on the other side, they have their quarrels with the social justice crowd and the radical individualization of identity to a certain degree and what comes along with that, because identity plays such a complex role in liberal belief, where identity is a very dangerous concept to the overall understanding of a liberal cohesion of a society.
I think that's true. And also, I would say that I have just framed this idea of wokeness as being about a radically individualized form of concept of personal identity. And it certainly is that. And by the way, I would say that this idea that wokeness comes from something called cultural Marxism is a kind of like nonsense or woo-woo that you get from the American right, basically, which you should ignore. It grows out rather, I think, of a different kind of origin, mainly postmodernism, actually. But the point is that also the radical left, the radical woke in this, if you will, not only have an idea of personalized identity, they combine it with the idea that certain groups who have a shared subjective identity are in some sense structurally oppressed by contemporary bourgeois society, and that there has to be quite radical action taken to address that objection. And this is something that liberals reject because it calls for measures which actually infringe very strongly upon personal liberty, freedom of association, for example, but also it requires radical redistribution of resources, interference with speech, interference with a whole number of other things which liberals feel very strongly about. And so therefore, what you can have is a belief in cosmopolitanism, but the kind of variable within the cosmopolitan camp is the degree to which it's combined with what is usually called critical theory, which is the idea that certain subjectively identifiable groups are subject to structural oppression of some kind, which is an argument I think that most liberals would reject or be highly skeptical about, and certainly would not accept as requiring the kind of interventions and actions that the radical woke require.
Yeah, I mean, the implications of this are still something we need to unpack. But like before that, I want to take a step back and say, like, essentially what you're arguing in the Great Realignment is that we have new aligning poles, and the spectrum and the classification in political analysis has kind of shifted, and we now have two poles. And if I break that down to the most essential, or in the most essential way of thinking about it, it's for me the way we kind of labeled our own seminar. We said it's liberalism versus populism. So yeah. You gave these categories different names. On the other side, on the one side, there's the cosmopolitans. On the other side, the national collectivists. But in essence, if I'm right, I would say this is nothing else than reshaping liberals versus populists, because you would label the national collectivists as the populist anchor, and maybe the other quadrant that is lumped into that. And on the other side, you have the broadly liberal camp that is now a dominant pole. In the past, the classical liberal / libertarian camp was kind of up for grasps. It was like kind of the power maker, and that's how it turned out in many societies, that classical liberals have aligned with the conservatives. But now we see that liberalism has become a dominant pole, if I understand that correctly. And yeah. On the other side, we have the populists as kind of the main pole. If I reframe some of your vocabulary, does it make sense? Would you agree to that analysis?
Yes, I do. It is worth saying that the liberal cosmopolitan pole is much wider than simply just classical liberals. So classical liberals are, and I think have no choice but to be, a part of that cosmopolitan liberal pole, if you will. But they're not even the largest part of it. It also includes the kind of Rawlsian social liberals who have become dominant in a lot of countries in the last 30 to 40 years. Indeed, one of the things you could say that's going on at the moment is that what we are seeing is a kind of coming back together of different liberal traditions which became separated during the 20th century. The classical liberals on the one hand, and the kind of Rawlsian revisionist liberals on the other. And there's a number of people like, say, John Tomasi in the United States who are arguing that actually the difference between those two kinds of liberal is much less than most people often imagine, that they need to get together. Now, another reason for this, though, is that the other pole you mentioned, what you call the populists, what I've called the national collectivists, they are increasingly defined by an explicitly and self-consciously anti-liberal politics. The core of their politics is increasingly an explicit rejection on both intellectual and practical grounds of liberalism. And these politicians, the political parties we can think of, like the RN, in France, or the AFD in Germany, or the Sweden Democrats, or in the United States, politicians like Senator Josh Hawley and Senator J.D. Vance, they explicitly find themselves as anti-liberal. They see liberalism as being the main enemy rather than socialism. Not they like socialism, but they see that liberalism as being their big interlocutor or big enemy and opponent. And so in that, given that you're seeing the rise throughout Europe with people like Viktor Orban, of people who argue for an illiberal democracy, as he calls it, who see themselves as leading a kind of anti-liberal crusade, this is going to drive liberals of all kinds together, because liberals who may disagree at the margins about certain matters of, say, how big the welfare state should be, are going to find that they have to ally with each other if they're going to preserve liberal institutions. This is the view taken, for example, in America by Shiko Sudamia in the project, the liberal project that she's launched recently at the Mercatus Center. And I think this is something that we can see is going to happen in country after country. The other thing this means, by the way, which I'd add to your description, is that the traditional center-right in many countries is being pulled apart, is being poles are torn in two quite different directions. So you can see this very clearly in Germany, where the CDU-CSU is now deeply divided and having lots of internal rows and arguments about how to react and respond to the rise of the AfD in places like the two recent elections in Thuringia and Saxony, and the other day in Brandenburg, where the CDU, some of the CDU have said, well, we really have to start thinking about maybe making a deal with the AfD and breaking the cordon sanitaire that has been erected around that party. And then on the other hand, there are people in the CDU saying, no, absolutely not. No chance of this. And you can see the similar kind of arguments going on a few years ago in the French right, in Les Républicains, between people who thought, well, they had to cozy up to Marine Le Pen and those who said, no, we can't do it. I think that argument is now over in France, basically. The people who were not prepared to work with Le Pen have departed the Républicains. What will happen in Germany, I don't know. Maybe the CDU-CSU will divide. You will know best than me what will happen. But what you can see in every country, you can see it with the British Conservative Party, is a kind of internal fissure between people on the centre-right who are ultimately loyal to a moderate conservative form of liberalism and people on the centre-right who are increasingly thinking, well, like it or not, and in many cases I fear it's like it, we have no choice but to cast our lot in with the populists.
And what you say for the Conservative Party is true for the other parties as well. You have a similar division within the Social Democrats, within the Liberal Party, maybe the Greens a little less. They seem to be more united. Yes. But the whole new development, or maybe not so new, but now really very obvious development around these parties in the societies now leaves them a little bit without orientation. So what to do? Because one thing is clear, to hand the country to populists or national collectivists, whether they are from the left, as the new Sarah Wagenknecht Bündnis, or on the extreme right, like the AfD, both certainly are no options. And both also seem to be well connected to the Kremlin, if I may say so. So how to pull the center together? I mean, there are so many colors around the liberal pole. How to find a way to work together, find different, maybe compromises, something that, is acceptable for everyone and would then maybe develop another gravity for the people in the country, because people are also a little helpless how to orientate themselves. Mm. They feel something is off with the AfD. They would never vote for them, many. And at the same time, where to go? So the impression I sometimes have is that some brilliantly, through communication, through flooding the communication in the country with lots of things, amongst them disinformation and all that, they really aim at keeping people disoriented, maybe numb in a way, and turn away from politics altogether. And that is also something that the party around, or the groups around the liberal pole, cannot inspire to let happen.
I think there's several things going on here. One of them is that whenever you have a realignment, this process of shuffling of the pack or reorganizing of where blocks of voters go is a whole part of the process. And I just described how it affects the right, but it's also obviously, as you say, affecting the left. In fact, if anything, it's affected the left for a longer period than the right. So what left-wing social democratic parties have throughout Europe is a division increasingly between some of their voters, their traditional working class voters, who now lean strongly towards the populist end. And on the other hand, their newer, younger, more middle-class professional voters, who are definitely in the cosmopolitan camp and do not want to have anything to do with the national collectivists. And this is pulling that coalition apart. So what you find with realignments is that coalitions are reorganized all everywhere. And so it's a bit like having a room, a classroom, where you have two groups of children on either side of a line, and then suddenly one whole lot have to go across to the other side, another whole lot got to the other side, and you end up with a completely different mixture of the way it was before. Now, the problem for the liberal cosmopolitan pole, if you will, of the emergent new politics that we have, is the lack of a kind of clear focus. At the moment, it's reactive, largely. It's reactive to the threat of illiberalism from the other side. And that means that there's a lack of a positive tune. It's one thing to try and rally people around a kind of defensive posture of protecting liberal institutions, constitutional government, and the rule of law from the threat posed by illiberalism. And you can see how this works in, say, Poland, where the Civic Forum has become the predominant, like, liberal cosmopolitan party. And it basically came together as a coherent force in response to the highly illiberal governance of the PIS, the Law and Justice Party, when it was in power for two terms. But it's only got it's only got a negative agenda. It hasn't really developed a positive agenda yet. And also, unfortunately, when it's come to power, it's then proceeded in many ways to replicate the kind of illiberalism of the PIS. So it becomes just a question of, well, which group is in charge to do the illiberal, you know, like messing around with the judiciary and interfering with the free speech of your opponents, which is not the way you want to go. So I think the problem at the moment is not only that the liberal cosmopolitan poll is internally divided and still, you know, divided over issues like, for example, should you have a large welfare state or not. It's also divided because it doesn't have as yet a positive message as opposed to a simply negative one of defending the status quo against the threat of the illiberal right. Now, in France, perhaps, with Macron, you have had a bit of a positive agenda. The problem I have with Macron, who in many ways I respect as a politician, I think he's a much more strategic and far-sighted politician than most of his contemporaries, is that the positive agenda he has is one of technocratic reformism, if you will, top-down, expert-led reform of the economy and society in line with basically what economists say they should be doing. And the trouble with that is that may go over great at Davos meetings, if we can refer to the WEF again, but it's not going to cut out much mustard with voters. It's not going to inspire anybody. And so what I think we need is work by think tanks like your own and my own, and also a new generation of liberal politicians who will rediscover, if you like, the liberal vocabulary, the positive ideals of liberalism, and to assert, for example, the positive ideal and value of cosmopolitanism and the kind of lifestyle that involves and makes possible, in opposition to what I think of as the obscurantist and backward-looking politics of people like Viktor Orban, Marine Le Pen, Giorgia Meloni, and the rest of them. So that's what is needed, in my view. And that's what, at the moment, we lack, which is the big challenge.
Yeah, and plus, I think that many have not yet understood the shift of the realignment in politics. So I recently translated a similar essay based on your very own essay onto the German political scene. Because I think the German centrist parties, and here maybe centrist helps us kind of a terminology of the established parties of the last alignment that you were talking about, the Christian Democrats, the Social Democrats, the Green Party, the Liberals, they are busy with fighting each other still. They haven't yet realized in my books, and that's why my essay is kind of a call for this particular audience to, and now I don't know whether I will be beeped out, but to get their shit together, okay? Because in the end, if we understand the implications of the Great Realignment in politics, then they have to understand that the enemy of the liberals is not the Green Party, even though we deviate from some of their policies, but these are not the salient issues. And second, the reason why we have our quarrels with them as liberals is probably a sociological issue. That for a long period of time now, for like 30, 40 years, so the whole time when these politicians have been in political business, we have been fighting with them over issues. And it makes sense in the old kind of realignment. So it's kind of sociologically understandable that now, as you said, like we were in this classroom, these were on the other aisle to a certain degree and on the old spectrum. Now that we have to come together, we can't bridge the gap between those political party lines that now should be overcome. And that's what in the real world plays out in Germany at the moment. And again, I don't want to make this too much about Germany. It's just such an interesting case study of one nation where the realignment is in process, where we can witness it. And here, the political actors in the center, amongst the more cosmopolitan poll, they are not yet understanding the gravitude of this realignment. And instead, yes, the AfD and the kind of left equivalent with the Bündnis Sahra Wagenknecht, and apologies to all our listeners, we can link to some resources in the show notes, they are gaining from all of that in the elections, because the center is fighting with each other. And that's an old problem that the liberal camp itself had. Coming back to your remarks about the Rawlsian liberals and the more classical liberals, my work has been always inspired to basically bridge the gaps between them. I'm a classical liberal and I like John Rawls. Like, John Rawls has a lot of interesting things to say. I disagree with him on some issues, but about pluralism, for example, John Rawls is one of the most important thinkers that we have in political theory and is a distinctively liberal thinker. So again, like, bridging these gaps in the liberal camp is now bridging the gaps in an even broader poll, which is the cosmopolitan poll, and to get that together is incredibly hard. But now let's pull all of that strings together, and we don't want to just talk about Germany, although of course it's so interesting. Yeah. But nevertheless, like, do you think this populist wave or the great realignment in politics is just a Western phenomenon, or where do you see this happening? And maybe just say a couple of words. Do you think some societies are already newly aligned? So
yes.
I think there are three spectrums, right? So first of all, how do we have societies that are already aligned, kind of case studies for your own hypothesis? Then second, where do we see kind of the transitioning process? I think after what I've said, comes at no great surprise that Germany is, I guess, in this transition period, at least according to my analysis. And then the last question, where will we see this? Is it like a global phenomenon? Has it played out in some countries already further, or are some lacking behind, or some, due to their to political nature, will not see a polarization in that nature of a great realignment? So maybe walk us through your thoughts on a more global perspective.
Okay. I mean, starting first of all within Europe, I think in France and Poland, certainly, and some of the other East European countries as well, Hungary, for example, the realignment is complete. It was completed some time ago. And so in those countries, you're in the new political alignment, very clearly. What's going on in France at the moment is simply, I think, the kind of working out of exactly what the nature of the poll opposed to the national collectivist is going to be. You can see this very clearly, you know, following Emmanuel Macron's courageous decision to call snap elections. Now, the, you know, courageous in the British civil service sense, that is, i.e. reckless and foolhardy. So those are countries where it's already completed. I mean, but it's not, there are also countries outside Europe where I think it's completed. One of them, for example, is India, where Narendra Modi and the Bharatiya Janata Party, the BJP, is very clearly a party of the populist national collectivist kind. And what has happened there is it has finally, after a long time, brought the liberal elements in Indian society together, and they finally checked Modi at the recent elections in India. Another country where it's complete is Turkey, where basically politics now is Erdogan versus his opponents, and his opponents are now a kind of alliance of the Kemalists and the actual liberals in Turkey against, who previously were strongly opposed against Erdogan and his government. So those are examples of countries where it's complete.
And before you go on, Steve, here, like, just one note for all our listeners. In our seminar, Liberalism Populism, we have three case studies that we walk people through and bring guests from the respective countries in. One is Hungary, Viktor Orban. The other one is India, Narendra Modi. And the last one is Turkey and Recep Tayyip Erdogan. So, like, as you said, like, the populists that we see in development, the populist playbook, is also the societies where this realignment, according to you, is complete.
Exactly, yes. And then you have countries where it's still ongoing, if you will. And I think Germany is one, the Netherlands is another. Maybe not Italy. I would put Italy into the camp of completed realignments. But Spain is another one where it's continuing, as is Portugal, with the rise of Cega and places like that. Austria is an interesting case because I think in Austria, in terms of the voters, it's completed. But maybe the Social Democrats and the People's Party haven't quite, you know, got their heads around that yet. Britain is another country where I think, very interestingly, it is completed at the level of voters, but this is not yet reflected in Parliament because of the way our political system works. And then you've got countries where it either hasn't happened or it isn't yet starting. In Europe, there's only one such country, which is really Ireland, where, again, there's been a major popular upsurge of attitudes and outlooks that I would describe as national collectivists, but this has zero representation in the legislature, the Dáil, as so far. I don't think that will last, though. Now, if you think about it globally, then I think that you can make that kind of threefold division that you've described. The part of the world where you don't see this realignment going on at all is East Asia. It seems that the East Asian politics of, say, South Korea, Japan, Malaysia, Taiwan, they have different issues there. That also, the politics works, I think, in a rather different way because of the very strong consensus orientation of certainly, say, Japanese politics, which means that you get lots and lots of arguments, but they tend to not be public arguments. It's a quite different kind of model of politics to what we have in Europe and North America, I think. So East Asia is not seeing this change. Africa, large parts of Africa are not, because simply, again, you've got a different political situation there. Very weak states, very often non-democratic politics. It's more factional, clientelist politics of a kind of pre-democratic kind. Latin America, on the other hand, yes, it's happening a lot there. There are several countries like Brazil, for example, which are in an advanced stage of the realignment, maybe even completed it since Bolsonaro's presidency. Peru, I think, is another country where the realignment has been completed, and the basic choice, as we saw at the last election now, is between a kind of left and liberal alliance and the national populist program of Keiko Fujimori, who's become the dominant force on the other side in Peruvian politics. And then there are other countries there where it's not yet complete. Argentina is an interesting case because Milei is definitely a populist, but he's not at all a national collectivist populist. And that relates to the point you made earlier that, in fact, in many ways, populism is not a substantive phenomenon. It's more a kind of style of politics or rhetoric. And Milei is undoubtedly a populist by that definition. He defines himself as the voice of the people against the elite, which is what populism is defined as being that way. But the content of his politics is this kind of radical, rather strange libertarianism. So he's definitely not in the same kind of page as, say, Donald Trump or, Giorgia Meloni. So Latin America is an interesting case because there is a history of populism there. But populism in Latin America has historically meant authoritarian rule by a charismatic leader, a caudillo. And this is a tradition in Latin America that you can trace back to people like Vargas in Brazil, Perón in Argentina, Perón, yeah. Any number of figures, Jiménez in Venezuela, for example. And undoubtedly, that's a long-standing tradition in Latin America, which means that the national collectivism in Latin America can draw upon that tradition. But I still, as it did with Bolsonaro, for example, in Brazil, but I still think that in many ways there's a novel aspect to it, which is the very complicated reaction that's going on in Latin American society to economic globalization, economic globalism, and of course, as always in that part of the world, the role of the predominant position of the United States, which is one of the reasons why populism in that part of the world can take either a left or a right form, because it's depending on whether or not the people in question are pro or anti the United States and its predominant role in that part of the world.
Well, you didn't talk. You didn't talk about the United States. I was like, where's the cliffhanger? Like now, especially this year, we have elections.
The United States is one of the countries where I think the new alignment is complete. I think it's very clear that the Republican Party is now a MAGA, I suppose we have to call it, party, a Donald Trump party. His choice of Vance as his vice president, I think, confirmed that. It shows that he felt absolutely no need, Donald Trump, to reach out to the old Reagan-style conservatives in the party. He picked someone who was very much of his own kind of persuasion, but more so, and also more intellectually coherent. A low bar, I know, but even so. And so the Republican Party in the United States, and I think, is now clearly a national collectivist party. And you can see a kind of mass migration of the old Reagan fusionist conservatives out of the Republicans into the Democrats. Hence people like Dick Cheney endorsing Kamala Harris for president. I mean, if you predicted that 10 years ago, people would have thought you'd been out in the sun too long without a hat. But that's how these things work out.
Yeah, I think like from a theorist perspective, this is like the kind of showcase scenario of the United States. So I was thinking like maybe you will start with that one, because the tremendous shift that we see between Democrats and Republicans is exactly the realignment, right? There's the never-Trumpers that to a certain degree are conservative cosmopolitans to a certain degree. I mean, yeah. They align with a new kind of liberal camp. So it's kind of a new fusionism. While on the other side, the MAGA party, as you call them, or as we all see them like evolving, are so clear positioned with the choice of J.D. Vance. Like he had the choice of like also going for people like Vivek or others, like where these are more economically minded and maybe have some libertarian leanings. But ultimately, he went for J.D. Vance, who is nothing else than like another culture warrior to a certain degree. And that's just fueling the whole theory to a certain degree that we have a national collectivist bloc right there. And Donald Trump becomes even more extreme by the day. Like now he's even wants to punish, as we record this, like the German car industry. So like it just gets like more and more absurd the way you can like extrapolate this poll to a certain degree, right?
Yeah.
I'm just wrapping my head around like this global picture. We have, and just to summarize a little bit for our audience, because always everything is very dense with Steve, like we have East Asia, where due to the style of politics, as you might argue, we don't see so much evolution also of the bipolar nature of, I mean, you have bipolarity also, I would say, yeah, in East Asia, but like the populist national collectivist style, maybe less so. Maybe just asking you about Taiwan, because in Taiwan, we still have kind of a populist resurgence, and we have kind of a poll of cosmopolitan liberals. But again, the Chinese issue, I guess, must be of uttermost salience. So, I mean, in terms of conceptualization, you can say a couple of words about itself, because it will make the theory clearer. Because me, I guess in Taiwan, the salient issue might just be very different. That's why we cannot compare. It's not the Western-centric view.
Yeah, that's exactly it. The thing is, if you're in Taiwan, the salient issue, obviously, is what your attitude towards the People's Republic is. That's got to be the big issue. And so the big division is between those who want Taiwan to not openly assert its independence as a sovereign state, because nobody in their right mind is going to do that. They know the Chinese state, the PRC, would not tolerate that, but who still want Taiwan to, if you like, push the envelope, become more distant from China. And on the other hand, you have the KMT, who basically still assert the idea there is one China, just they think they should be running it, not the Communist Party, and who therefore are open to the idea of some kind of reunification with China at some point. So that's the big issue there. And that means that this kind of realignment that I'm talking about here simply doesn't apply there, because you're dealing with a different geopolitical situation. Similarly, for countries like, say, Indonesia, Malaysia, or the Philippines, perhaps, it's a different geopolitical set of issues that apply there. It's more about the relations with China, relations with the United States, the role of Islam in the country in the case of Indonesia and Malaysia. Japan has it very, just as always with Japan, it's got its own unique and distinctive kind of politics, I think, which you simply can't map onto anywhere else in the world. And I think the same is true in many ways, South Korea, which again has a very distinctive approach to politics. So I think that whole part of the world simply isn't taking part in this transformation. I would say, by the way, that one of the interesting things about my sort of thesis and about what I see in the world looking at it through those lenses is the degree to which you're seeing a global phenomenon, because this would not have been the case, say, 50 years ago, 70 or 80 years ago, where even within Europe, it was, you know, each individual country typically had its own kind of particular politics, political cycle, however much overlap there might be in some ways. And I think that one of the things that's interesting about this is the degree to which we're now dealing with a global phenomenon, and the degree to which the political cycles of countries are becoming aligned. And I think that's obviously a product of globalization and economic integration. The fact that the world is in many ways much more highly integrated, much more economically united than it was before.
Well, to a certain degree, I agree. But on the other side, it seems to me that, for example, the phenomenon that like social democracy and the whole battle of systems that came out of the kind of the Cold War of like free market economics and social redistribution slash more state intervention. That kind of thing was also a global phenomenon. Like, I think the global phenomenon of, like, for example, social democracy is something that has shaped many societies around the world. We have we now see it, of course, with populism on another stage level, because we are kind of witnessing the real alignment happening. And again, I'm just summarizing for our readers. Okay, we have distinct blocks. We see, I think, the hotbed of populism and the realignment is, of course, in the liberal democracies. That's where it's also most relevant. I mean, the realignment is less relevant for a military dictatorship, right?
So yes.
We look also, it's not the Western focus that we want to have on this podcast, but like the hotbed of kind of political innovation, if anything, Europe is innovative in like political systems, one might say, and populism is pulling the strings there. Then we see it lesser so in other regions of the world. We have a distinct flavor of populism, as you explained, in Latin America, but nevertheless, also flavors of this new realignment. And of course, the global showcase where everybody's looking to, and especially later on with the election, is of course the United States. But let's transition over. And I think, Bettina, you want to dig deeper onto the realignment itself.
Yeah, because I would really be interested in where do you see the causes for realignment? Is it just that people get tired of what has been done the last 40, 50 years? Mm. It's something like what Guido Westerwelle, former liberal party leader, said, like late Roman decadence. So people are not inspired by anything anymore and are not really, they don't know a purpose they have. What is it? Are there external maybe external reasons now, you know, the rise of other powers when you think in geopolitical terms, maybe perceived as a threat. So what would you think might be the causes that this realignment now happens? Really, it's like domino pieces. One country after the other is somehow infected. Some are through already, some are in the middle, some maybe face it soon enough. So where do you see the reasons, of course?
That's a very good question. I mean, the thing is that part of my perspective on this as a historian is that realignments occur at fairly regular intervals. So in the British case, where you can see it very clearly because of Britain's having such a very long and stable political history with no, you know, foreign conquests or major revolutions, there's been 8 realignments since the late 17th century. So it's something that happens roughly every 40 or 50 years. The scale of the realignment varies, though. So we had one in the 1920s that was a really, really big one, a major one. That was when economics became the big aligning issue. We had another one in the 60s and 70s that was a minor realignment. It was only the secondary issue that changed. The primary issue didn't. But I think there are basically 4 causes for realignments, really. And the degree to which these are the driving force varies perhaps from one time and place to another. One of them is just a generational shift. It's simply a matter of one lot of people die off and they're replaced by another lot. In this case, earlier on, I think Sven said, you know, you're dealing with boomer politics. And as the boomers, my own generation actually, gradually...
Apologies.
He does that to me regularly.
As we go on to our reward, then, you know, we're replaced by other people, you know, the younger generation, the millennials and so on, who have a different concern because they've had a different life experience. So it is partly a generational effect, which is why I think, you know, 40 years or so seems to be the lifetime of a stable alignment. Another one is undoubtedly geopolitics. Geopolitics, for some countries in particular, can be a really, really big force driving politics because the relationship that you have to the rest of the world is typically a very big issue in many countries. And obviously, if the geopolitical templates shift, if you get a kind of shift of the plates of world politics, if you will, then this often has a major driving effect. And I mean, Bettina, you mentioned earlier on the degree to which a lot of these national populists are just a little bit too fond of Vladimir Putin, shall we say, and for comfort. And that undoubtedly is an example of the way in which geopolitical shifts are then playing out in domestic politics and tending to go along with other things. And there's no doubt, I think, that hostility towards or skepticism about the United States tends to correlate, for quite obvious reasons, with skepticism about cosmopolitan globalism, given that until very recently, the global economy has been dominated by the United States. So geopolitics can be a cause. Another reason, very often, and I think this is perhaps the major factor in the current one, is the exhaustion of old political divisions. What happens sometimes is that one argument, either it's won decisively by one side or another, or people just stop caring about it. So in the late 19th century, and in fact the middle of the 19th century, one of the big political issues in most European countries is religion and the relation of the church to the state. So you have all these arguments about whether or not you should have an established church in Britain. You have the Kulturkampf in Germany under Bismarck and big rows about the Catholic Church and its role. In France, there's all the huge arguments between the right, the quintessentially Catholic party, and of course the left in France, the liberals and the socialists, are people who favour laïcité. And then suddenly, quite abruptly, by the early 20th century, nobody cared about this anymore. It just completely fell off the radar. And at the same time also, what we've had in the late 20th century is that the issue between socialism and communism or socialism was decisively settled, because it became very, very, very clear that you cannot have a modern economy that will work and have a socialist economy. You can only really have one flavour or another of capitalism, which has led several people to say it's easier to imagine the end of the world than the end of capitalism, usually said rather bitterly by people who wish we could imagine the end of capitalism. But nonetheless, it's a wide and accurate perception. So that's, in that case, there was a decisive result to the argument. And so that is no longer the kind of existential choice that we face before. So the exhaustion of aligning divisions, whether through people getting bored with them or they're being decisively resolved, in either case, they lose their salience. That's another possible cause. And the fourth cause is, as I said, I think the reason why issues have salience is that they reflect or derive from structural divisions in society. And so major technological or socio-economic change can also radically change the nature of the political debate. And so what, in a way, led to the salience of the debate between capitalism and socialism was the rise of a mass working class, a very large working class concentrated in cities, working in large workplaces with a distinct class consciousness, which was not happy with its position in society and wanted a quite major shake-up of the way things were, combined with, on the other side, an emergent middle class and a capitalist business class, which obviously didn't want this. And so that's how that all then played out afterwards. Now, you could argue that what we're seeing at the moment is a kind of different set of socio-economic divisions, which have to do, I think, with two things. One of them is the shift of the world economy from a model where the basic building blocks or units of the world economy are national economies, like the German economy, the French economy, the British economy, to one where the basic units are city-region economies, which are then globally connected to each other through a network of trade, capital flows, popular movements and the like, and which creates a situation where, let's say, Munich has probably closer connections with northern Italy or even with North America or Eastern Asia than it does with, say, Eastern Germany. Or London is more closely connected to New York and the east coast of the United States in many ways than it is with, say, Newcastle-on-Tyne and the north of England. So you have a world economy which now consists of a network of globally connected metropolitan areas. And this is associated with a kind of economy which is dominated by immaterial production. People are no longer making physical stuff so much. The really fast-growing parts of the economy in the areas which tend to generate the highest income is people sat in offices in sectors like finance, tech, IT, publishing even, leisure and entertainment, doing work producing non-material products which are globally traded and globally produced and which can't be really physically rooted to a particular place where they're manufactured. And the people who this is finally connected to, a labour market organised around the principle of meritocracy, the idea that the way you get certain jobs is by having academic qualifications. And this provides, these create completely new divisions in society. A division between, on the one hand, the globally linked metropolitan areas like Munich, for example, and the rural and also ex-industrial areas, areas like Thuringia or Saxony or the north of England or eastern Pennsylvania, which are semi-derelict ex-industrial areas or rural areas, which are not part of it. And also a division between people who have been through higher education and those who have not, for one reason or other. And that, by the way, is the biggest single predictor of how you will vote in almost any country. And that reflects, I think, a new division in society, a division between what the British author Mary Harrington calls the physicals and the virtuals, the people who are still engaged in the physical economy versus the people who are engaged in the virtual economy, the latter of whom are typically more highly educated. They've had to go through university to get the role that they have. So what you've got is socioeconomic change, which has produced quite new divisions in society. And this is then, you know, feeding through into therefore quite new political divisions.
Wow, that was a wide arc. But I would say for Germany, especially, it is true that, you know, it was all the same somehow. All the political parties, you earlier mentioned government more seen as government by technocrats and not so much by ideology or visions or so on, which also led in Germany, the AfD is called the alternative for Germany. So they try to marketing themselves as being something else, something different, and not part of what has been there before. So something new. We also see in other countries going against the so-called elites and so on. It also, it's part of the playbook in a way, but it lands in people's heads as well. But with all this leading to an alignment, I could imagine that there's another wave of of alignment when you think about what is coming towards the Western society. I'd love to talk about them. At the moment, because in many of our countries, we have a huge demographic shift with very old societies, lots of elderly people. So these countries need immigration. And at the same time, they don't want it. And the other thing would then be technological change. How will AI and even deeper automation of the production and everything, could this then ignite the next alignment, and where would you see maybe that look in the glass bowl?
I agree completely with that last one, actually. I think that over the next couple of decades, the economic issue is just going to fade steadily away, basically. And I think it's going to finally become an issue only of interest to a small number of economists and not many other people within about 20 years. But I think the issue that is going to then rise up the scale and gradually replace it is the question you allude to there, Bettina, that of technology, and in particular the degree to which we should accept or welcome radical technological innovation. And in a way, this is the issue that Ginny Postrel raised in the book I mentioned, Future and Its Enemies, all the way back in 1998, because with things like AI, what you're seeing are technologies which are going to have, I think almost everyone agrees, radical transformative effects. But you know, whether you think those are good or bad, however, is another matter. And so there are increasingly, I think, going to be people who will argue, and this again is an issue which cuts across our conventional understandings from the old alignment of left and right, that we should basically be thinking twice about technology. Maybe we should not simply accept all the new technology. I think we're starting to see already a big pushback against the smartphone and an argument that maybe we should be thinking about certainly banning smartphones for kids, saying that nobody below the age of 18 should have a smartphone.
Jonathan Haidt, right? So that's the...
Haidt and others, indeed, saying, I think with increasingly strong evidence, actually, that it's caused a epidemic of psychological problems for young people. Or people saying, well, we shouldn't have smartphones at all. We should just basically scrap this whole technology. Maybe we should just think it's a bad idea. And I think this whole argument, a kind of neo-Luddism versus technophilia, is going to become a very, very big issue in the next 20 to 30 years, particularly also with the new technology that doesn't get as much publicity yet, but I think will do soon, which is biotechnology. And the ability of using techniques like CRISPR and TALEN, particularly CRISPR, to significantly alter the genetic code of animals and human beings in particular. And you will get all kinds of arguments about, well, should parents be allowed to use genetic editing to tailor the genetic makeup of their children? So that, and on one hand, people say, well, this means you can make sure your child has no inherited illness. But on the other hand, people say, well, hold on here. You're using this to make sure your child is tall, very attractive, intelligent, and this kind of thing. We don't want this. This is basically private, you know, family-level eugenics. It should not be allowed. And this is going to become an extremely big argument. And I think it's going to be one of the, you know, going forward into the next few decades, it's going to become one of the great arguments of our time. Should we socially control technology or not? And it relates.
But could it be salient? Like, that's what I like with migration and the demographic issue that Bettina raised. I see it is salient, and that's the big question that is underlying the great realignment that we see now to a certain degree. But like, could the technological question that like Elon Musk and others are pushing, could it become a salient issue? I don't think we are there.
Yeah. No, I think it will become the minor issue, basically, rather than the dominant one, precisely because it doesn't quite have the same salience. Now, I agree that the other issue you mentioned, this demographic collapse that Elon Musk is now worried about, which he's doing his personal best to arrest, it would seem. I forget how many children he's up to now. Is it 16, something like that?
11 on my last count, but like, I don't know.
Right, okay.
I don't care.
But he, that I think is definitely going to be the salient one, because there are two things going on here. On the one hand, you have a global demographic bust, basically. People don't realize this is not just a matter of developed rich countries.
It's China as well.
All the world, apart from parts of Africa, is, I mean, South Korea, I think, has a birth rate at the moment from like a TFR of 0.9, which is incredible, really. I mean, that means South Korea will virtually disappear as a population within about 50, 60 years. Now, that's one side of it. The other side of it is that in the global south, because of the commercialization of agriculture in that part of the world, which is what has massively reduced global poverty, so an unmitigated good thing, you also have, therefore, about 2 billion redundant farmers, because the commercialization of agriculture means that you can produce food with far fewer farmers. And it also means, on the other hand, that you can no longer get by on really, really low income, because you now need cash to buy food. And so what you have in the global south is about 2 billion redundant farmers. Now, most of them are going to migrate to large cities in Africa, Southern Asia, Southeast Asia. But about 10% of them are going to look to migrate north. And if you do the maths, that's 200 million people. That's an enormous number of people who will be looking to migrate into countries which also desperately need that labour, because they're elderly populations with a declining age workforce. But obviously, this is going to be a major issue. And I think it's one of the reasons, by the way, why in country after country, and we saw this in the elections you just had in Brandenburg and elsewhere, young people in Europe are the most likely to vote for the national populists. You can see this in France, you can see it in Germany, you can see it in many other countries, not in England, interestingly. Britain is an exception in this regard. But everywhere else, that's the pattern. And that's, I think, because the younger people, the people under the age of 30, are the ones who feel, on the one hand, most resentful that they're being taxed to pay the pensions for the boomers like me, and on the other hand, threatened by this kind of demographic transformation that they can see coming as a result of the demographic collapse of their own societies and this displacement of former farmers from the global south.
And they have huge tasks ahead. I mean, when you think about climate change, I think we just talked about how do we deal with the advanced technology and so on. So they know they have quite some tasks at their hand.
Not surprisingly. I mean, there are all these figures and statistics which may have to do with the smartphone again, that Gen Z, or whatever they're called, the very youngest generation, are
like, the Zoomers,
pressed about the world, yes. But you can see why they feel they've got a lot on their plate, 22, 24-year-olds.
Yeah, we seem to have a lot on our plate, and maybe to shift over to kind of the last talking point that I wanted to dig into. Bettina mentioned the topic of climate change and what we have seen in terms of salience. Climate change has dropped off when it comes to the salience issue, and that is surprising because many people might have predicted in the past that climate change will be the aligning process of those skeptical and those who are very far ahead. And when we look at Europe, and that's what I want to talk about now, when we see Europe, the Green New Deal, and however it is called in the European Union, has been something, a cause of, to a certain degree, polarization. But after all, bigger issues such as the one of national identity also seems to come to the European Union. We had EU elections this year, and I think you have always been very vocal about the future of the EU, Steve.
Yeah.
So rather quickly, what is the future of a subcontinental, supranational institution like the EU, especially after the new EU elections? Will we see there this realignment really playing out, not only on a national level, but on a supranational level? Because then we would have it even more on steroids to a certain degree. If we think about national identity on a supranational level, we have now an elected parliamentary group that calls themselves the European Patriots, that want to shift the European Union to a certain degree towards the more right wing. How do you perceive the future of the EU?
Well, I think that it's going in, I'm afraid, the direction that I have been expecting it to go in for quite a few years now, 7 or 8 years now. A couple of things are going on at the moment. One of them is that partly under the pressure of the war in Ukraine and the way that's been going and the increasing militarization of the Russian society and economy in response to that war by Putin, you're seeing a growth in central executive power. Under Ursula von der Leyen, the European Commission has been arrogating more and more decision-making power to itself at the expense of the Council of Ministers, essentially. And so you're seeing the gradual growth of a much stronger central power in Europe, alongside the obviously ever-increasing role of the ECB. At the same time, you've got people like Emmanuel Macron who've been arguing that this is what has to happen if Europe is to acquire some kind of freedom of action on the global stage and not be constantly hanging on to the coattails of the United States. And Macron has been making this case, again, ever since he became as president. So you've got that going on. But at the same time, you had these elections in Europe. And I think what you've seen clearly in the last few months is the emergence of a very coherent populist bloc. You mentioned them, the Europe Patriots for Europe, as they're calling themselves, basically.
Yes.
And I think what we are seeing here is the emergence of a kind of national collectivist party, parties like the Austrian Freedom Party, the RN in France and others, who are, they've given up on the idea of Frexit, you know, France leaving the EU or anything like that. They realize, first of all, that their voters won't stand for it. And secondly, that actually in the world we're now moving into, countries like France or, you know, Italy or Austria are not able to act as really independent actors on their own. Certainly if they're going to deal with things like the migration problem, which for these people is the central issue of politics. And so what you're seeing is the argument that actually you need some kind of, you're almost a pan-European nation, a sort of civilizational state, which is a kind of idea that's doing the rounds in these circles in Europe now, that what the EU should develop into is into some kind of decentralized, but nonetheless singular civilizational state. One where you have a much more powerful center, which can conduct a kind of coherent foreign policy, defense policy, probably monetary and ultimately fiscal policy, but which at the same time has a great degree of decentralization. So the idea is that you would have a more powerful EU center in some ways, but it would certainly over policies like migration, foreign affairs, and defense. But at the same time, it would stop enforcing a whole lot of other regulations to allow greater national autonomy. Now, I think the key thing is that what you've seen is a divergence between this kind of right populist politics and the more kind of radical one, which you can see with the AfD, which has formed this other group, the Europe of Sovereign Nations, I think they call themselves.
Yes.
And these people, the AFD and the parties that have currently gone along with them, some smaller parties, maybe the Confederation Party in Poland, for example, they are emphasizing, first of all, they're far less hostile. These are basically pro-Putin parties, explicitly so. They do not share, because all the other parties, the parties in the Patriots for Europe, they are parties that have pulled back a very long way from their former pro-Putin position. Marine Le Pen, you know, was at one point taking money from Putin, you know, cozying up to him. Now she's distanced herself very sharply. Same with Giorgia Meloni.
Giorgia Meloni, yes, I've won.
Very much so. Now, whereas on the other hand, the AFD, and also some of the other people we could mention, they're still very strongly, like, you know, on the idea that we should make a deal with Ukraine, you know, cut a deal with Putin over the body of Ukraine, basically, divide Ukraine into three parts, like Gaul or something like that. And so I think they are, and they are also much more aggressively hostile to an integrationist trend in Europe. So I think we're seeing a kind of bifurcation within the new emergent right-wing pole of European politics. And the great majority of them have gone down this route of supporting more levels of integration in Europe, but in the service of a very nationalist, civilizational, anti-migrant, and therefore anti-Muslim, anti-African agenda, basically. Now, there are two other groups I think it's worth mentioning. On the one hand, you have the PIS and Giorgia Meloni, Fratelli d'Italia, who have not joined this new group. And that's because I think they're still not convinced about its attitude towards Putin and Russia. They still, Meloni and obviously the PIS, because being Polish, are much more skeptical about or hostile towards Russia. Poland, for obvious historical reasons, no Polish politician of any political persuasion is going to regard Russia with anything other than the deepest suspicion, I think. And so therefore, those two parties are potential future members of this kind of populist coalition, but at the moment they're holding off. On the other hand, you also have the Bundessaar Wagenknecht and a couple of other parties, the Romanian Social Democrats and the SD Smer, I think it's called, in Slovakia, who are, in some senses, if anything, they're in some ways they're on the same page as the more radical right parties because of their sympathies for Putin and demands for there to be an end to the war in Ukraine. But they're also very explicitly social democratic, left and economics, and they won't join up with the main body of Patriots for Europe because they think they're not sufficiently social democratic. So that's a third tendency that's begun to emerge, if you like, in politics, particularly in Eastern Europe, I think, in the former communist parts of Europe, a kind of politics that is left populist, if you want to call it that, very left of economics, and explicitly like nostalgic for the old communist days in many ways, but at the same time also therefore very nationalist, very anti-migration, but much more sympathetic to Putin for, again, obvious historical reasons. So I think those are the three groups we can now see on the populist side in Europe. And I think that two of them are going to merge. I'm pretty sure that eventually the PIS are going to forget the fact they don't like Viktor Orban, and they're going to merge with that party, the Patriots for Europe. And it will become one of the dominant forces in the European Parliament. Now, the question what will happen then is, I think what we will see is a kind of historic deal or compromise between people like Emmanuel Macron and people like the Patriots for Europe, which is that the Patriots for Europe will agree to and support the kind of growth of a strong centre, maybe a merging of sovereign debt, the growth probably of giving the Commission genuine fiscal powers, which is the big thing it doesn't have at the moment, and which I'm sure Ursula von der Leyen would love to have. And in return, a kind of emphasis on the European project as being about the creation of a civilizational state for a Christian, predominantly white Western Europe, which will be defined as being effectively independent of the United States and also very wary of or hostile to Russia. And that will basically be a Western Christian, basically Catholic and traditional Protestant kind of state. And I can see that very much as being the direction that Europe is going to go in. Obviously, this will be resisted by others. But I think that at the moment, the geopolitics is going to have a big force in driving all of that.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds to me like an awful lot like a realignment process, but then on a supranational or pan-national level. I think that is the worrisome thing. I am not sure how the polls will in the end play out, like in polls, not in terms of Poland, but in terms of the bifurcation of all of this, because we are there witnessing, again, a realignment process, but then on a supranational level. And that might be very interesting to see how that hypothesis is playing out in the future. And as people can see, Steve is a wealth of and a fountain of knowledge and talking ready on many of the issues. We touched upon several today, where we talked about the populist wave from a more conceptual perspective and also from a strategic perspective, because if the realignment hypothesis is true, as I have my sympathies towards, then this gives at least liberals a clear-cut compass on how to react in a political realm, although they haven't understood it, as I've argued in many of the societies that I'm living in. But it would give at least them not only a conceptual understanding, but a proper strategic outlook, maybe to strengthening the center and overcoming some established bridges from the past. Now, we close in this podcast with always asking a question where I'm particularly excited to ask this question to Steve, as he's an avid reader, one must say. And we usually ask our guests to tell us or to recommend us one book that liberals should read but haven't read enough. So, Steve, we sent this question to you beforehand, so maybe you have a good book recommendation for all of us. What did you cook up?
Well, I have a couple of recommendations, actually. One of them is a book that is very much in the news these days, and that's Dune by Frank Herbert, the famous science fiction novel. Why should liberals read that book? Well, because that is actually underlying the narrative in that book is a profoundly unliberal or anti-liberal view of the world. Frank Herbert, people don't often realize, was like way over there in terms of his politics. He was like, way to the right of, most people for the last few hundred years. And the whole book is actually partly about attacking ideas of individualism and the idea of liberal progress. And Herbert is a great writer, in my view. And so I think reading that book is a great insight into that. The other book I'd recommend is a book called How to Live as a Liberal. I'll send you the recommendation afterwards. This is a book that has just come out, and it's essentially about the way in which liberalism is a philosophy not only of the public realm, of government, but also of how to conduct one's personal life. That, in other words, it's a philosophy that contains not only a belief in things like the rule of law and personal liberty as a political good, but also in living your life in a certain way, one that involves the virtues of things like self-governance, personal responsibility, respect for others, and interacting with other people in a certain way. And I think that this is a book I've just sort of like just picked up. And it's a brilliant book in my view, and I think everyone should read this and think more about the kind of issues that it raises.
Yeah, like this couldn't be more timely. It's certainly not scripted. I think you refer to liberalism as a way of life. And,
that's the one, yes.
Yes, yes, that's what I just bought yesterday. So I just had a glimpse this morning while reading it, because that's obviously something very up my agenda. So, and at the same time, I'm listening to the audiobook of Dune. So I'm really tuned into the two recommendations you gave. It couldn't be more timely. And thanks, Steve, for that, because now I can make more sense of my own reading list, because obviously I haven't watched the movie. So instead, I go back to the book. That's a lifestyle choice I deeply regret for many issues. But anyways, thank you very much, Steve, for walking us through the great realignment in politics. And to all our listeners, thanks for tuning in. You can get in touch with Steve also on his Twitter account. You can follow him. There he puts out all sorts of hot takes when it comes to politics, especially the EU and British politics. So follow that and Stay tuned for the next podcast that we are pulling out. Thank you, Steve, for joining us, and see you all in the next episode.
Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.